today. I trust you had a comfort break, an opportunity to grab a cup of coffee and talk over those burning questions. They were excellent sessions to start off with, weren't they? Really super. Well, it's my privilege to introduce our next speaker. Just before I do that, can I just remind you that on the back of your little program here, right at the road time, it says text your questions to, and the number's there. Please do make use of that. We've got a few questions that have come in, and of course you can ask them from the floor as well. But after Paul Hatcher has spoken, we're going to take a 2-minute break, get the sofa in place. Julia Chanterey will be here, and we can have a fun time asking all these questions that are coming in. So Paul Hatcher and I met in Shoreham at a business breakfast, which is run by the Shoreham Academy, which happens to be where we meet as a church on a Sunday. And Paul and I got talking, and we had breakfast together. Well, did we have breakfast or just coffee?
Just coffee.
Oh, okay. He's complaining now. But we had a time to chat together, and I heard Paul speak and thought it'd be excellent to have him come and address us as well. So Paul's going to be tackling the psychology of sales, and I know he's got a great session for us, so let's welcome Paul as he comes.
Breakfast today? Bacon and eggs? No, I had the almond croissant. That's okay. Well, to be honest, yeah. I just want to say again, Jill just did a fantastic job. When I saw the subject she had to do,
I was blown away by that. I thought, well, when I saw the subject, I thought, rather you than me. And as I was listening, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I wish I'd heard this 5 years ago. And so my first question is, who am I and what am I doing here? That's what I used to ask myself when I was doing those cash flow forecasts and budgets and just saying, this is ludicrous. Why does anyone have to do this? It's a declared non-strength of mine. But my name's Paul Hatcher. My background, varied one. My first deal I ever really did in business was when I was 16 at school. I used to go to King's Manor, now called Shoreham Academy. And I said to my headmaster, you need to let me leave early. This is around about May, 30 years ago, I've just realised, 1983, because I've got an opportunity to take a job as a photographer's assistant. Now, for anyone who's old enough, you'll realise that in those days, if you could get a job, that was a miracle. If you could get on a YTS scheme, that was, you know, not bad. And if you could just get out of school, that was even better. And basically, this guy was offering me a job. He was run off his feet. He'd only been going for about 2 or 3 months. And I just wanted to be a photographer, so I said, you know, I'll come and do. I worked 12 hours the entire summer. Said to my head teacher, Mr. Whitehead at the time, if you let me go, I'll promise I'll revise and I'll come back and I'll do my O levels then. And the flaw in the plan was that I only walked away with 2 O levels, which is not very good, really. And the worst part of that story was that by the end of the summer, the photographer decided that actually he couldn't get a YTS scheme going because he was just a freelance. You have to be a limited company and all this stuff. So the whole thing fell apart. And quite honestly, at the time, I remember going to the park in Shoreham just feeling like the bottom of my world had fallen out. So I went from building site to building site, ended up in Israel working on a kibbutz, picking bananas, all sales related, obviously. and it's true, though, when you think about it, everything that we do, actually, there's a sales element. It doesn't really matter what it is. Dare I say, even people that work in church, you know, you're selling the idea of salvation. You've got to present that.
It draws people to want to really, you know, buy into what we're representing.
Okay.
So,
there's going to be a bit of coordination going on. So then, done a whole variety of jobs. Moved to London after having lived in America for a brief period of time, and finally managed to break into the great glamorous world of broadcast television. This is what I want to do now, not photography, moving pictures. And managed to actually sell 2 of my own ideas, one of which was a Dispatches Channel 4 documentary, which was a real highlight at the time. But either side of that career, which was about 7 years, and we were pretty much selling TV programs. I was working for independent production companies, draw up an idea, go and pitch it to a commissioning editor, and they say yes or no, basically. But I cut my teeth in sales as a commission-only financial advisor. And that really is hardcore. I'm talking a West End office where if you've run out of your friends and family to phone, they give you a yellow pages. And you don't sit down until you've made 50 phone calls before lunch. And then every time someone makes a sale, they've managed to drag a client into the office. They ring a big fat bell and everyone's, yeah, yeah, yeah. It was really gung-ho. And eventually ran out of steam for that. and realised somebody told me that you can actually get a job in sales where they pay you a salary, they give you a company car, a brand new company car to drive around with, a laptop computer, and a mobile phone. I thought I was in heaven. That's just amazing. You know, so you actually get paid to do this, and you get commission on top of that. That really was a revelation to me at the time. So did that for a number of years, and enjoyed most of it. And then eventually, about 8 years ago, Jane here, my wife and I, started a small business called Prosperity Brownies. Started out with no cash, no plan, and really no idea what we were doing at all. And the long and short of that story is, I'd like to be able to stand here and say, you know, we sold it last year for £2 million, and you know, we just do what we like now. It's quite nice. But the truth is, we really ran into that situation with the cash flow. We could see our pictures over the top of that slide. It was quite scary. And that was a classic situation because we didn't have a plan. And so I'd really encourage you to, if not go on the Navigator course, certainly grab her at the end and get whatever you can. So what we did, we actually shut the business down in terms of the local suppliers, local customers, and we are now still in talks with Virgin Atlantic, ironically enough. So I was speaking to my contact the other week, Richard he's called. not Richard Branson, of course. But it was a guy called Richard, and he likes the brownies, and you never know, they might still take off. So that would be really fabulous. Keep you posted. In the meantime, that's actually released both of us to do stuff that's really close to our hearts. And for me, I've been accredited as a coach for a number of years, but never really had the time and the energy outside of what I was doing on a day-to-day basis to really throw myself into it. So I'm now doing that, and I coach all sorts of people. From, I was with a blue chip director of a massive company yesterday, and he's now going to take me into his senior leadership team, and we're going to hopefully cascade the whole stuff that he's been learning. Really, I love talking with people and helping people with their work-life balance, because so many of us, hands up if you feel like that could be a potential issue for you. I'm not trying to pitch for a coaching client, by the way. But, you know, we need to work to live, don't we? Not live to work. So anyway, that's a little bit about me. Finally, a little plug, because Jill did do a really good plug, and I thought, I've got to then get my flyer out. I haven't got a book to promote. But peer-to-peer, from this company I'm working for called Artesian, they hired me. They're a blue chip kind of company. Their bread and butter businesses, Deloitte, Ernst & Young, McKinsey. They do a lot of stuff in the NHS. There's stuff all over the world. And I'm really excited to be working with them. But I'm kind of wearing my sales hat because they're quite a small outfit. But they're about to pretty much quadruple in the next few weeks, even, to be honest. And one of the things I'm doing with them is developing a product where it won't be happening in Brighton for a few months, but if you're interested, if it hands up if you're an owner, CEO, MD, managing partner of a small, medium enterprise. Okay, well, if you're interested in the idea of meeting up with like-minded people from non-competing industries once a month and really spending a whole long day, we're talking like 8:30, bacon sarnies, all the way through till about 6, with people helping strategize together. I was talking to someone in the coffee break where, you know, you can actually, it's worth a lot of money when you can learn from somebody else's mistakes. So, example being, we want to spend a load of money on social media, but we haven't really got a clue how to do it. Should we just chuck a load of money at it, or should we drip feed it? Should we test this platform, test that one? And somebody across the table says, well, we were in exactly the same position 2 years ago, and we did actually chuck a load of money at it, and it cost us a lot of money, and we should have done this. So you instantly save potentially thousands of pounds. So that's just, if you're interested in that kind of concept, come and grab me afterwards. So, I'm here to talk about the psychology of sales. Now, when similar, Matt's obviously got this strategy going, did it with Jill. You know, would you like to speak? Yeah, that'd be great. I was flattered, you know, wonderful. And then he drops me an email about 2 weeks before the day saying, could you deliver something on the psychology of sales? Okay. Thankfully, I just read a really good book that actually talks about the psychology of sales, so that was good timing. So I said, yeah, okay, how about this for a start? And we kind of got some stuff going, and then he said he'd take me for breakfast, but it was just a coffee. But that's Matt. No. Good guy, Matt. And he's from, well, he's not from Shoreham, he's moved to Shoreham, so that's even better. I mean, you know, Shoreham is just, like, amazing. So listen, the psychology of sales, if you Google that, there's about 10 years worth of reading material, and you can, by all means, go on that course for the rest of your life. But for me, I just pulled out a few things and looked at stuff I'd read and just, basically, I've been in sales, I guess, in one way or another for the last 25 years. And I thought I'd start off with talking about, where do you think the word sale or sell comes from? Now, I'm sure most of you would agree that it's obvious, really. It comes from an original word. Usually we talk about original Greek word or Hebrew or something like that. And the word sell comes from, you know, it actually means to bend someone's arm back and cajole them, persuade them sometimes. If that doesn't work, torture them to do something that you want them to do and you're convinced it's going to be good for them, but actually it's all against their will. You'll be pleasantly surprised to see that's not true. And actually, it comes from the old English word, salan, which means, wait for it, to give. To give. Now, when I came across that, I thought, wow, that is amazing. I love that. And that, to be honest, underpins everything I want to share with you. You're probably going to have to give me funny signals when I'm getting near that time. Because really, I've started to learn, and I guess when I read this book, it's called Principled Selling. I'll touch on it towards the end. But if you want to make a note of that, it's written by a guy called David Tovey, T-O-V-E-Y. And I just found it randomly in Waterstones, one of those glorious Saturday afternoons where I was free to do whatever I like. I had a coffee and sat in there for 3 hours and read about four books or these samples of them. And this was one of them, and I thought, wow, this book is amazing. It confirmed everything that I've always felt about sales. But to be honest, most of that 25 years, I've had to report to someone else, and they say, well, how many cold calls have you done? Like, you know, the financial advisor stuff. 50? You haven't done 50? There's no way. You know, get back on it. The truth is, the days of cold calling are over. They really are. You can do them. You can do them all you like. And that number there, what was it? What was the number you started with at the top of the funnel? 206 clients. I guarantee you, that's actually very, very good going. You're probably talking, put another zero on that 200. And then you might get somewhere near the five or six. Because people's trust is at an all-time low. And they don't want to be browbeaten. They don't want to have their arm up their back. You know, they just actually want to know that there's something there of value. So this is all about how do we produce value? How do we actually help people understand that what we're trying to do is really a good thing? You know, it's that whole deal. So, microwave versus the man. I'm just going to throw out a whole load of different thoughts here. If you want to jump something in, then, you know, let's be a bit interactive. But, you know, if not, that's fine. So we all live in a microwavable world, don't we? And for some reason, we all have got into this system where we think that, hands up, please be honest now, hands up if you've ever sent a text message or an email, even in the last week, let alone the last year or ever in your entire life, where because you didn't get the reply, you know, within an hour, you're starting to think, what's the problem? And certainly, if it goes into the next day, hey, our relationship is under serious threat here. I know I do, and I think I'm quite gracious, you know. And this is, I'm talking about personal friends. I'm thinking, what did I do? You know, was that text at the wrong time, a bad time? Does anybody relate to that? Or you're just complete saints, okay. The truth is, the way we sell has to be in the marinating format. We have to learn how to marinate our relationships, our interactions. And how do we do it? You know, when you go to someone's house and you have an amazing dinner, and it might be a barbecue, it could be something they've just, you know, they've marinated the sauce. You say, what do you say? You say, what's in the sauce? So I don't know if you've got any guesses, any suggestions. What would be the number one ingredient in a marinade that actually motivates your client rather than manipulates them?
Trust.
Any guesses?
Trust.
Look at that. Have you got any cookies? Okay, trust. Trust is the number one ingredient. And we all know that you cannot just get trust like that. It has to be earned, doesn't it? And it can be destroyed in a second. Wrong word, wrong motive, wrong text, whatever it is, you know, you have to earn trust. And the only way you're going to earn trust when you're in a selling position, I suggest, there's a number of things, but the two that I was thinking of the most is authenticity. Now, how do we get authenticity? And what do I mean by authenticity? Well, what I mean by authenticity is basically being yourself. You know, actually being the deal, you know, doing what you say you're going to do on the tin. So I'll give you an example. I was thinking about the best kind of visual example of this. My idea would be, let's say you've got a prospective client coming into your office and they walk up to the director of first impressions, also known as the receptionist. I actually saw that on a desk on a reception years ago and I thought, that is genius. It's true, isn't it? They are the, you know, talk about way up their self-esteem and their value. They are going to be performing all day long to any Tom, Dick and Harry that comes by them if they realise that they are the director of first impression. So that's another little tip for you, if you've got a reception, that is, anyway. So they walk in and they're thinking, this receptionist, he or she, not going to assume that it's a she, actually, it's really nice. They don't look like they're, you know, kind of put out by my presence. They actually appreciate the fact that I'm here because I might be doing business with their bosses. And so they're really sincere. They say, oh, why don't you take a seat and I'll bring you over a cup. Would you like macchiato or latte or cappuccino? So whatever you would put in your reception to reflect best on your business. So again, I thought, what would be a good example of that? Let's say you're selling high quality and very expensive, but great value. Value and price is not the same thing. Great value stereo equipment, so speakers, headphones, you name all that stuff. Why not have, you've got your leather sofas, you've got your amazing all singing, dancing coffee machine, you've got a nice bit of art on the wall, you've got some magazines on the coffee table, but you've also got some plug-in headphones. So while they're waiting, they can actually, wow, this is pretty incredible stuff. I suggest that the best possible experience, the best way of being authentic for your business from entry level into the reception is actually them feeling like, you know what, you can leave me here for an hour. I know I said 11, but 12 is fine. And then maybe we could do lunch, or I'll have lunch in the reception, you know, it'd be fine. Because, you know, you're just completely blowing them away. You really are. So that's just one example. I'm sure you can think of a lot of others. And if you buy that book, which I do thoroughly recommend, it's only about 10 quid, there's a whole heap of material in there. The other thing that I am really big on, and my wife very graciously reminds me when I'm slipping a bit, is generosity. And what I mean by generosity, do I mean giving away a huge discount for your first sale for this prospective client, this brand new client? No, I don't. And in fact, if I was as organised as Jill here, I would have I saw this years ago, I've never been able to track it down though. There's a really scary, don't ever do discount unless you absolutely have to, because when you start to look at a, I don't know what you'd call it, like a flow chart or whatever, the more discount you give, it exponentially increases the amount of sales you have to get just to keep the same margin. So it's a bad, slippery slope. Don't go there. So you sell value, not price. But what I do mean about generosity is that you're willing and able and quite happy to invest a lot of time, energy, and commitment into your client. And I guess one thing I would say is it's like the difference between Argos and Amazon. And we have a son, he's nearly 13, and just about to become 13 next month, so we will have a house of three teenagers, so please think of us. And come round any time, take them out, do whatever you like. Maybe not bring them back even sometimes, no. So David, our youngest, completely untainted thus far. No, he money is attracted to him. He's like, he's got the biggest net worth in the entire household. He's working for my dad as we speak and getting paid between £25 and £30 for the privilege of it. And he's not even 13. So anyway, he's always got money, and so he thought, he plays in an award-winning basketball team at his school in Worthing, and he wants to practice hitting his hoops. That's the right terminology, right? Hitting, I'm a bit illiterate when it comes to basketball, but I've watched enough of it now. Anyway, so he buys this thing from Argos for 50 quid. 2 weeks later, this is in the height of winter, I have to say, but still, the metal that's holding the hoop up is kind of rusting, and it literally falls off, and as far as I'm aware, no one was hanging from it. Maybe the next teenager, I don't know, but as far as I know, that didn't happen. So it snaps off, okay, you've got to try and take it apart, put it in the car, go to Argos, and say, and actually it happened 2 days before was when the receipt kind of deadline was if you want to exchange or even get a refund. So I said to him, I'm going to wait in the car, don't even think about coming out until you get the money. No, I did go in with him. And we go in there, I'm trying to teach him. And he actually went in there, and we're like, you know, it's only 2 days, but it's been Christmas, I think that's what it was, he spent some Christmas money. And they try to fob us off with another one. I'm like, why would we want to buy another one? When actually, you know, this is really obviously not up to the job. So we got the money and jumped in the car, never went back. And then about 3 weeks, or no, for several weeks now, he's been saying, I really want to buy this other one. It's much higher spec, Dad. It's really good. It's 150 quid. And I'm like, really? 150 quid on a bike? And I looked at it and I said, okay, fine. It's your money. You do what you want. So he orders it online, uses my account on Amazon, so I have to get the money off him and then all that. But he orders it. It says Amazon says it's going to take 5 days, 5 working days. So this is around about a Wednesday. So I said, look, realistically, it's not going to be until Monday or Tuesday, free delivery. It arrives on the Friday. So he's blown away because it's here in 2 days. No problem. So the lesson here is never over-promise. Always under-promise and over-deliver. Because now he's an Amazon fan for life. He's never going to go to Argos, but he's always going to go to Amazon. But get this. When Jane and I are the ones who are actually getting it out of the box and assembling this thing, which takes, certainly if it was me on my own, about 3 weeks, but it took us about 3 hours, there's a hole in the backboard. There is a point to this story. There's a hole in the backboard, so I'm like, oh, we can't even finish the job. So he comes home from school and he's really gutted. I have to get on the phone to Amazon and they say, look, no problem. What we'll do is send you out a whole new kit. And I'm like, I know, I don't want a whole new kit because I do not want to take this thing apart. In fact, you've gone past the point of no return with one of the poles and blah, blah, blah. And so they say, no, no, no. All you have to do is get the new box, take the new board out, put the cracked, the one with the hole in the new box, and we'll send someone else round to take that away. And I'm like, job done. That's great. What's the difference in the experience? Argos, Amazon. I suggest everything is different. And that's just an example that I can think of from my own situation of generosity. They will always do better than Argos because that's what they do. They will make sure they deliver. They will make sure, they've obviously got that potential hindrance of, you know, transit, damage, blah, blah, blah. But actually, that is the way that you run a business and look after your clients. Okay, so if you have authenticity, generosity, you get trust. I like to call it the trust triangle, but I'm also a fan of acronyms, but I couldn't really think of a really good one. So you've either got TAG or GATT, whatever floats your boat really, but you know, I'm not really keen on any of that. So trust, you know, the triangle of trust. Do you get that? Okay. So really what I'm saying is the psychology of sales should equate to your psychology of life. So, you know, it's a little bit more like being authentic. Be yourself. You know, everything that you value in your life should be replicated in the way that you deal with people on a day-to-day basis. The sale, the deal, if you like, is just a byproduct of that. So hopefully what comes out of you is generosity, it's authenticity, it's kindness, it's respect, it's being reliable, trustworthy. All those things that you can think of that are nice words about yourself, and if there's a few in there that you think, that really wouldn't work so well, then that's something you just need to look at. But that is what will give you a good psychology of sales. Remember that happiness is not the other side of the deal, because when you're thinking it is, then you're going to be too desperate. I worked with guys in that office 25 years ago where, because it was commission only, and we had a boss, who remembers an Australian guy called Alan Bond? He nearly went to prison for owing the Bank of Australia, whatever, about 500. He said, if you owe the bank $5 million, you've got a problem. If you owe them $50 million, you've got a big problem. But if you owe them $500 million, they've got a problem. And that was his philosophy. So when us struggling commission-only salesmen were going, George, he was like a disciple of Alan Bond, this guy, Aussie franchisee of a financial services company, he would say, come with me, I'll get you another bank account, and I'll get you a $5,000 overdraft in 1988, which, you know, is a bit scary. But there were guys in there earning £20,000 a month, you know, really crazy numbers. So there was something they were doing right, but actually, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on there that wasn't so good. But the guys that were desperate were the ones that, you know, I've got to pay the rent, I've got to eat, so I've got to get this deal. And that's why that whole industry and so many others like it have had to be regulated. You can't go that way. You can't live like that. You've just got to flow, offer the value, be yourself, be generous, be authentic, build the trust, and the deals will come. They always do. Okay, what's next? So, happiness is not the other side of the daily life like an obese. I hope it's the right one. It's really there. All you've got to do is step into it. Don't let your happiness, and I definitely used to be a victim of this. Jane would always know if I've had a good day. I'd come in, I'd bring a bottle of wine, I'd be smiling like a Cheshire cat because I'd just close this deal. Even the terminology, close the deal, is questionable. You know, you actually want to open the relationship and the deal comes. I can't express that more. Okay, so throw out the microwave, master the art of the marinade. Be like Joe. This is my favourite story. I thought I'd do a little Google on who is the world's greatest salesman, if there is such a person. And there's a guy called Joe Girard, G-I-R-A-R-D. And Joe Girard has got the world record, I think in at least two counts. Number one, for selling most cars retail over a longest given period of time. From 1965 to 78 or something like that, 15 years, 13 years. He sold 13,000 cars. It's an average, I think, I did the maths right, of about 16 cars a week, retail. Now, the emphasis is on retail because this is just normal people like you and me walking in. It's not a company going, I'll have 50 of those. Phenomenal success. And he also holds a world record for most cars in one day, which was 18. Can you imagine what kind of day that was? Okay, you know, just let me just open up the doors, you know. 18 cars in one day. What do you think, now I need a bit of interaction here, what do you think his secret was? Do you think it was shining the cars every day at 6 in the morning before anyone came, or new suit every day? Any ideas, any suggestions? I'd love to hear. We're talking the world's greatest salesman. So there's obviously a secret.
Passion.
Huh?
Passion.
Passion. I'm sure he did have passion. And in fact, do Google him, because I don't think I'm going to have time to read this, but there's a story worth reading, because it wasn't the most ideal upbringing. Let me say that much. Come on, any others? Just throw them out.
Good reputation,
yes. Like, no wrong answers here.
Likeability.
Yep.
Honesty.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny.
Funny, I'm sure he made them laugh, yeah, when they got their checkbook out. $10,000? It's a bargain, Joe. Anything else?
Good cars.
Sorry?
Good cars.
Good cars, that's a prerequisite, isn't it? Because you're never going to get a repeat business if the cars, you know.
Maybe he was out just to help people out.
Absolutely. That's getting very close. No, he's actually given me the two words that the Guinness Book of World Records said. Well, actually, they don't say it. It says it in Google. So they must be right. Wikipedia.
He made them feel special.
Ah! Another cookie, please, to the lady. Two words. His secret, greeting cards. If you even wanted to become a customer of Joe Girard, and certainly once you became, they said there wasn't anyone actually who thought about it. When you came to see Joe, you walked out of the car. That was the end of the story. And it wasn't the swan neck method. Once you became a customer of Joe's, or even were on his radar, you would receive a greeting card of any description for the rest of your life, every month pretty much. Anniversary, Christmas, holidays, weddings, bar mitzvah, Halloween, anything that was going, you would get a card from Joe just saying, just thinking about you, thanks for that order the other month, looking forward to seeing you next time, probably every, what, 2 or 3 years, you know, at the most. At his peak of his performance, as it were, he had two people he personally employed sending out, guess how many cards a month? 13,000 a month. 13,000 a month cards, 13,000 and one card, his career total. That's phenomenal. But the key is obviously in the relationship. He was building relationships. He was giving them value. Why would they go to Joe? Because Joe's card is always on the mantelpiece. So when even someone comes into their living room and says, oh, do you know anyone I can speak to about a card? You know, there's so many dodgy guys out there. Speak to Joe. He's great. I haven't seen him for 3 years, but I get a card every month. You know, how easy is that to do today? Just a click of a mouse. You can even send auto whatever it is. You know, I can't remember what it's called. Auto email. Something like that. Okay, so be like Joe, or not like me. This is one of my best friends, Brian. Why do I put that up there? Not to boast about our... this is exactly 2 weeks ago. We were staying on the highest peak in England, Scarfield Pike. And Brian knows it like the back of his hand. He's from Manchester, so bless him. He knows Lake District is fantastic. He had a compass, a map, everything that I thought looks great, but I wouldn't have a clue what to do with. And we get up there in 2 hours. He said it's going to take 4 hours, and I was thinking, after 1 hour, there's no way I'm going to make this. But anyway, we're up there, you couldn't see much. But the reason I put it up there is because on the way to the Lake District, Brian was telling me about his former neighbour, who is actually a used car salesman. So in the kind of top five, or maybe even the top three of most loathed or least trustworthy professions, alongside, what, politicians, journalists, I don't know, one or two others. No estate agents? No. Okay. Let's call him Joe, just to keep the flow moving. So what Brian does, he tells Joe what kind of car he wants, and he doesn't want a brand new car, he's smarter than that. He actually is quite happy with a two-year-old car. This is my budget, I'd like leather seats, I'd like climate control, cruise control, nowadays I'll have a camera for when I reverse, all that stuff. And Joe goes off and finds the car for him and gives him a couple of options. You could have this one or you could have that one. And on this particular occasion, Brian's new car that he's got now, Joe found himself at a car auction and saw this Volkswagen Passat, which he absolutely knew Brian would love. But the trouble was, the mileage was remarkably low. It's 2 years old, it's only about 8,000 or 10,000 miles. So the price was a lot higher. So obviously what Joe does, you know, Brian's told him he wants to pay, say, £12,000 for it, give or take. So Joe's thinking, if I can get it for 10, then job done, I've got my margin. And it's all open book stuff, there's no secrets. So Joe takes a bit of a fly and thinks, I'm sure Brian will like this, and I'm sure he'll understand about the margin that's kind of impinged. And so he buys the car there and then, brings it back to Brian, and says to Brian, there's the car, and Brian loves it, and oh, wow, it's only 8,000 miles, that's amazing. That's what a great job, Joe. And Joe just kind of says, snag is, it kind of cost me an extra £500 into my margin because of the mileage. And Brian's like, oh well, thanks a lot anyway, that was great. You know, I really appreciate that. And he's a bit like that, Brian. But a couple of hours later, goes online and he puts the difference in Joe's bank. So when I was going to do this 60-second pitch, hoping that I was going to get more than five people in here, I was going to say, come and hear me talk about how a used car salesman actually managed to get an extra 500 quid out of his customer rather than going down. And that's the reason. Why do you think that is? It's because Joe doesn't just deliver cars every two or three years to Brian. He actually supplies value and relationship. And Brian was saying to me, you know I could look around, I could do a bit of this, bit of that, and maybe save a couple of hundred quid, maybe, but why would I bother? You know, I've got a good relationship with this guy, I've known each other for 10 years, I know he's not going to rip me off, I know he's going to get the best deal he can get for me, and if it costs me a little bit more, then it's going to be worth it. So again, it's not about the price or the money involved, always. It's about the value, it's about the relationship. Okay, so principal selling, a couple of technical things here. Principal selling is all about relationships. If you haven't got that already, then you are asleep. No. So, fundamental, and therefore the salesperson has to learn the art, not just of the marinating versus the microwave, but actually how to motivate rather than manipulate. See, traditional sales, I'm sure we've all been around long enough to know that when we think of a sales role or come up with some adjectives for a salesperson, typical salesperson, you know, manipulation would be somewhere along there in that top 10 probably. And that's just so wrong. And that's why people are struggling in the world of sales. So you have to M2M. You have to motivate people to meet you. And then once you have a meeting with them, you've got to structure that meeting to motivate them to buy from you. Now, how do you do that? It's quite simple, really. It's not as complex as it might sound. All you've got to do is take stock and stop thinking about yourself so much and think about them. Think about their world. What are their issues? So that's why, again, you know, it's highly advisable to actually try and carve out a bit of a niche. Don't try and be all things to all men. But carve out a niche so you really do become the go-to person. You become the famous brand. You become the Joe Girard of brand new cars at Chevrolet. Because you actually know their world backwards. So you can empathize. This is why I love this so much and it relates so much to coaching. Because you know, when you come into a coaching session, it's not about, if I was to sit down with Matt, I'm not going to tell him all the stuff I know. That's called mentoring and there's a place for that. But, and he's older than me, so he would be mentoring me. But coaching is about listening. It's very counterintuitive. We've got two ears, one mouth. So you've got to listen, I've got to understand his world, and then I'm hopefully going to ask some half-decent questions. And if I've got a little bit of supernatural stuff going on, I can actually ask some questions, which he's going to go, whoa, I need about an hour to think about that. Or sometimes go away altogether and come back next month. You know, so if you can have a meeting like that, I guarantee you're going to motivate so many more people, and those statistics going back to that funnel are going to be quite shockingly impressive because you've changed your entire approach. And if you do the numbers, you're going to get some good figures. I'm not saying you just see one person a month and do this. Okay, what is your purple cow? Hands up if you've ever heard of purple cow marketing. Okay, about a fifth. That's good then. So you guys can have a coffee or... Purple Cow Marketing is a guy called Seth Godin, worth looking up again, buy the book. It's only a tiny little bit, you can read it in about 2 hours. Some great examples of Purple Cow Marketing. First of all, let me show you the visual. If you were driving along Sussex countryside and you saw a bunch of normal Friesian cows, you don't really stop, do you? You just think, I've seen those since I was a kid, if you brought it up here like me. But if you actually drove past them and you saw one purple one at the front, you'd be like, You'd reverse right up the road, pull into the nearest label and go, my gosh, where's my phone? You know, I've got to tweet this, got to fake this, it's amazing, let me get a picture next to it, you know, you're doing all that crazy stuff. And the point being that purple cow marketing is all about creating a genuine wow factor. It's in the experience, which comes as a result of the relationship. Are you with me? So you don't just sell good drinks, you know, you sell drinks that maybe are interesting to read on the label. So Innocent Smoothies heavily influenced us when we started. You know, the whole idea of dialogue with your consumer was a brand new concept back then. And so now I think one of the best examples I've ever seen is the recent Coca-Cola bottle campaign. Who would have thought you'd be in a Tesco Express and see three or four people who are not homeless digging around in a bin looking at bottles? And I'm standing there, oh, it's my turn now. I've got to, oh, I really wanted to get it, you know. And I was driving home from the Lake District the other week and I was pulled into this service station. I thought, oh, I know, I'll buy Jane a bottle of Coke with her name on it. That would be really cool because she's missed me for two nights and actually she's out already. No. So I'm literally pulling them all out of this fridge, which the person is carefully because I usually go for the back to their colder anyway and all that. And I could not find a single one. David, I'll try David. No, certainly not going to get my first two kids, J-A-E-L, and Isaiah. Forget it, it's not going to happen. But it's such a brilliant idea because, you know, we Everyone confessed that you like Coke at one point. You may pretend that you don't like it now because you're a health nut or whatever, but the fact is, it's the most successful drinks brand in history. And I just think it's pure genius that they put names of people on such a simple idea. And then another idea, which Michael E. Gerber talks about in The E-Myth, Revisited, another book if you haven't read it. He goes regularly to a hotel in Northern California, just off the Pacific Coast Highway, where they've got his details, probably because he logged in, booked it online and everything else. Maybe they have a bit more of a deeper chat at the reception. But he was blown away the very first time he stayed there, has a lovely meal, just there on business, so he's there on his own, goes into his room, and not only is there a raging fire in the fireplace, but there's actually his favourite drink and his favourite newspaper on a table next to the fire. He's thinking, that's amazing. They didn't have to do that. They secured the information. So many businesses, data capture, you know, you go to an exhibition, why do you think you have a badge with a barcode on it? You know, next year CCK will have a barcode on it. And they scan your details and suddenly you're in their system. Now, if they went another step further and actually bothered to find out what your favourite little things like that are, again, customer for life. It's so simple. So that's the question, what is your purple cow? You must have one. If you don't, you need to find it. Okay, coming into land now soon. I used to love driving on the A23, especially coming downhill. You know that bit on just after the BP garage, the last service station, at the trees, and it's like I used to pretend it's like a mini chicane because it really was. You know, my challenge every time I was coming home, a bit dangerous if it was a long day, is not to use the brakes. So I'd stay obviously within the speed limit, there or thereabouts, but never use the brakes, because it's just like, yeah, that was good. Now it's all gone, they're taking the trees down, and what's worse, they've got this average speed camera. Rubbish. And so, hands up if you've actually got cruise control in your car. I'm not trying to be elitist here or anything. Okay, I've got it as well. It's the second time I've had it, and it's only the first time I've actually started to use it, because I was getting really frustrated thinking, I need to get to somewhere, and I was going north. And I thought, okay, I'll lock it into 40 because, you know, it's easy, you know. I happen to know that if you go no more than 44, so 10%, you're going to be fine. Don't tell anyone I told you that. But if you go to 50, you're pushing it. Anyway, the point being, I've got a car that's the whole length in front of me, so that whole set of chairs out, and I'm here. And I'm thinking, okay, I have a bit of fun here. Just click that button up to 42 miles per hour, 5%. So I call this the 5% factor. And I couldn't believe it. 2 miles per hour extra, and I just left that car for dead. I was having the time of my life now, and you know, this goes on for 10 miles, doesn't it? So my suggestion to you, my challenge is, you know, you've heard all the time, I'm sure, you know, what would your sales look like, what would your business look like if you increased everything by 25% or 50% even? That's a tall ask, you know, that's a lot of extra work. So I would suggest a small, bite-sized, little bitty step, 5%. 5%, I guarantee if you apply some of these things that you're learning today and continue to learn, hopefully, 5% extra, where will that get you? I think that's the question next after. How much more effective would you be? I bet you'll start overtaking some of those guys, because some of these guys think the 40, to stretch the analogy, that's all they need to do. They're just jogging along, it's okay, I'll get my regular clients, it's all good. But actually, just a tiny bit of extra, one notch on the cruise control, because I'm not really an advocate of cruise control in life, you get me? You've got to be going as fast or as hard or as well as you can without messing up your work-life balance. So it's a tricky balance. Work hard, play hard, but don't live to work. Okay. Finally, where is your mountain? This is my favourite shot from my Lake District trip. This is halfway up Scarfield Pike, and it got my most likes, so I'm really proud of it. I can't remember, I think that's Waspwater Lake there. But my question for you as I leave you is, where is your mountain? What is your mountain? Because we've all got a mountain. And I wanted to say, I was thinking about this even just this morning, it's very easy for us in business and when we come together in times like this to assume, really, it's a vast assumption that everyone's happy in business. Everyone's got the business of their life. You know, it's all going great. It might just be, there may only be one person. There might be 5 or 10 even, who actually you're starting to think, you know what, this business is killing me. I'm not making any money. You know, what should I do? I need to do something different. Or it might be that you haven't got a business, but you'd like one. Whatever your situation is, I want to challenge you with asking yourself that question, where is my mountain? Or what is my mountain? Because I totally and utterly believe that we all have a mountain in life. And for those of us in business, a lot of it's to do with our business, but as we've heard earlier, a lot of that's to do with delivering value, not just to ourselves and our clients, but to our community, to our world. And as you do that, you know, it says, doesn't it, if the Lord your God gives you power to create wealth. And that word really means to create value in your community. And then the money comes afterwards. If you chase the money, you'll never stop running. So where is your mountain and what does it look like? And I challenge you to go up it, and half the time it may take you only 2 hours instead of four, 20 years instead of 40, or whatever. And then when you get to the top of that mountain, not only will you have an amazing experience seeing what's beyond it, but I guarantee you'll be so inspired that you want to come back down the mountain and inspire a whole bunch of other people to do the same thing for their life, for their world. Question number 7, final thought. I couldn't have 6 questions, it had to be 7. This comes from a guy called Howard Thurman, who actually was the predecessor to Martin Luther King, civil rights campaigner in the 20s and 30s. And he said, don't ask what the world needs, but ask what makes you come alive. Because what the world needs are people who have come alive. Because if you are flourishing and you are alive in whatever it is that you're doing, even if that meant actually laying down your business and going to work for someone else, or volunteering or doing whatever, then that is what the world needs of you. Thank you very much.
And just for record, Paul and I think Paul's about a week older than me.
How did you find that out?
It's great. Obviously, I'm trying to find out about my customer. That's right. No, super, brilliant. Why don't we just have 1 minute break, say hi to the person next to you, do a star jump if that makes you feel warmer.